I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Touring in support of her critically acclaimed new album, Clover, Jada Kelly's Canadian tour comes to Vancouver. The wolf don't hunt like it used to. Jada Kelly is live at the Railway Club Thursday, October 17th at 6:30 p.m. with special guest Dylan Stone. Clover is available on Divergent Recordings. Tickets available at the Railway Club or online at therailwayclub.com.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
SpongeBob! You're wasting me precious carbon dioxide! I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy! Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool!
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable! Big business does it again!
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
A well-known pick.
Wartime Racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Exploding Head Movies. Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest.
Hello and welcome to News 101. Today is Friday, October 4th. I'm Nina Krigia.
And I'm Talita Kali. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:06 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent news. Today's broadcast is all about our segments from hardworking, independent UBC journalists. We're going to start off with Talita's segment. Talita, tell us a little bit about what you're going to do.
I'm going to be talking about the UN's recent global warming report.
Cool.
Yeah.
Go on with it.
So the UN recently released a 35-page report for policymakers by the IPCC, or International Panel on Climate Change, a shortened version of the 2,216-page full report. This report attempts to tackle the views on causes of global warming and climate change, which has been a widely debated issue for decades. Drastic climate cooling and warming is a natural occurrence that has resulted in ice ages, floods, and mass extinctions. However, it is the recent change in the Earth's temperature pattern that are cause for concern. While some believe the global warming that has been taking place is another natural and non-human caused event, many others think differently. With industrial expansion and the system of mass production that has been prevalent since the beginning of the 20th century, the world's carbon emissions have been increasing, and with it, the Earth's temperature has been rising in increments that have resulted in suspicion about the nature of this temperature rise and what it may correlate with. On one side, there are those who believe that the global warming occurring is another natural event. These individuals include the International Science Coalition, which is a group dedicated to presenting what they believe are the facts about global warming in a more truthful light, believing that much of the information concerning climate change is grossly misinterpreted and exaggerated. This coalition released their own report before the UN in hopes to provide what they believe is an oppositional stance to help balance this debate. This report was done by the Non-Governmental Panel on Climate Change and was 1,200 pages. They were sponsored by the Heartline Institute, which unfortunately has a history of taking questionable stances on issues. They state that while the Earth's average temperature has been rising, it has also flatlined or leveled out. Many in support of this opinion will constantly refer to the fact that Earth's natural heating and cooling systems have been going on since the beginning of time, and we must adapt and we must adjust to these changes. This report, however, will focus on the fact that the UN has ruled, and I quote, "It is extremely likely that human influences have been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century." They state that the Earth's temperature will rise another 1.5 degrees Celsius and that melting glaciers and ice caps will contribute to a 26 to 82 centimeter rise in sea levels. Now, as one reads the UN report, certain words and phrases begin to automatically stick out, such as very likely or virtually certain and with high confidence, phrases that may raise suspicion in how exactly accurate this report is if the panel members are not willing to use definite terms. The UN's 95% certainty is not only enough for many, is obviously not enough for many who don't believe that global warming is human-caused, and do believe that it is a tool used simply for political and social means. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, has stated that in 2014, a gathering of government leaders and experts will be held to discuss a new political commitment to helping the climate temperatures and their regulations. This could be seen by many as a power play of sorts, a gathering of leaders who compete for the title of frontrunner in the fight against climate change. Since the UN report, governments have been given out recommendations to their political leaders on how to respond and help cooperate with efforts towards climate change. Some, however, still unconvinced, have chosen to reject these recommendations. This opinion, however, does not stop the fact that with a 95% certainty towards that human activity is to blame for climate change, that we should be taking drastic actions towards lowering our carbon emissions and implementing strategies to help control our impact on the environment. For Canada, if this 90% certainty is to be taken seriously, we should expect to see extreme weather conditions that include floods, thunderstorms, and cyclones. The fact that Canada is closer to the North Pole and an Arctic landmass is concerning, since it is at the poles that climate change will be felt the greatest. Our vulnerability towards natural disasters is clear from the tragic floods that took place in Calgary and Toronto. The ability to control these events once they occur is impossible. But experts believe that with lifestyle change and a solid commitment to lowering our carbon emissions, that the effects felt by climate change could be prevented. The UN report states, each of the last three decades has been successively warmer at the Earth's surface than any preceding decade since 1850. In the Northern Hemisphere, 1983 to 2012 was likely the warmest 30-year period of the last 1,400 years. With this data collected from satellites, computer logs, over 10,000 scientific peer-reviewed papers, and by having consulted over 600 scientists to compile these findings, this report should be taken seriously and not pushed aside simply because skeptics may believe it is of no concern. There is no reason why we shouldn't actively try to improve the environment that we live in, and while it may be difficult, the UN's findings are nothing but proof that drastic changes need to be made.
Thank you for that, Talita. That was really good insight for us to be definitely cognizant about right now. Next, we have Christine's Hot Topic for this week. Christine roamed the streets of the UBC sub today and this week, asking students what they thought about the recent kind of uproar about the Canadian National Anthem and how it kind of has sexist wording in it. So this is Christine's Hot Topic for October 4th.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's segment of The Hot Topic. Earlier this week, campaigns to make the national anthem of O Canada gender neutral sparked nationwide debate. Supporters of such a change, including famous Canadian figures like writer Margaret Atwood and former Prime Minister Kim Campbell, set up a website called restoreouranthem.ca. Apparently, the lyrics of O Canada had been changed for an unknown reason back in 1913, from Thou dost in us command to In all thy sons command. Campaigners believe that restoring even a small part of the anthem contributes to the larger goal of gender equality within Canada. But what do UBC students think about this issue? Should the Canadian national anthem be altered to be more gender neutral? So what would you think about making the national anthem gender neutral?
I think it's good. I mean, like, making it gender neutral, I don't think it's gonna affect that much. It's gonna be like, it's gonna include more people, like everyone, instead of letting like the other gender apart. So I think it's good.
Sorry, what's your name?
My name is Corbin.
Corbin, awesome. And what faculty are you in, Corbin?
I'm in forestry. forestry. Awesome. So what do you think about making the national anthem gender neutral?
I think considering that the original lyrics were gender neutral and there was sort of just an arbitrary decision to make it more patriarchal, that it's totally sensical and a great idea to revert back to the gender neutral lyrics that we started with.
Awesome. So do you think it will have a really big impact?
I think that with something like that, it's meant to send a message. Just changing a few lyrics in a song isn't going to help sexual equity in Canada or gender equity, but I do think that it's a step in the right direction, and it's a very public way of establishing, like, Canada wants to become more gender neutral.
Oh, I saw that on the radio.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Do you have any opinions on it? What do you think about that controversy? Should we make our anthem gender neutral or not?
I don't see it as a huge issue. I think the way it is right now is traditional, and I think changing the anthem is a bad idea. Even though it's not gender neutral, I don't think it's something that needs to be gender neutral.
Why is that?
You know, I don't have a legitimate reason for it. that's all I have to say, though.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, so what's your name?
Caroline.
Caroline. Okay, and Caroline, what faculty are you in?
Music.
Music. What do you think about making our national anthem gender neutral?
Well, I think it's definitely something that's... I can understand why it's being discussed at the moment. And I can understand the merit in doing that, although I feel like it would be hard to change the national anthem at this point. It's kind of just... It's so identifiable, and it's Canadians identify with it. So it would be... I don't know. It's definitely something to think about, but it would be a really bizarre change.
Can I have your name, first of all?
Farhad Ghaderi. Everybody calls me Far.
Far. Oh, Far, what faculty are you in?
Arts.
So what do you think about making our national anthem gender neutral?
Okay, I think it's not a really big deal. If you say songs, at the same time, it's not like... But I think, like, in the moment that the anthem was made, perhaps saying songs didn't have, like, a gender or, like, a burden or something. And I think if they change it right now, it would be cool.
Will it be necessary?
No. I don't think so.
Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
What's your name?
Jordan.
Jordan, awesome. And what faculty are you in, Jordan?
Mining engineering.
Mining engineering. Okay, so what do you think about making our anthem, like national anthem, gender neutral?
I wonder what it'll change. I don't really see any benefits coming out of it. I think it's the heart is in the right place, but I'm not really sure what the actual action would do.
So what's your name?
I don't want to give you my name.
Okay, anonymous. Do you mind letting us know what faculty you're in?
Chemical engineering.
Chemical engineering. So what do you think about making the national anthem gender neutral?
I think it's a great idea.
Any reasons why?
It shouldn't alienate anybody in our society, especially a group as large as half the population.
Okay, so you do think it's going to have a really big impact on the way we see, like, gender equality and... Like?
Probably won't make much of an impact.
Okay.
But I'd like to see it. I think it would be the right thing to do.
What's your name?
Paige.
Paige. And what faculty are you in, Paige?
Sauter.
What do you think about making the national anthem gender neutral?
It's a good idea, but I don't know, it's been a tradition for so long that I don't think it's that big a deal. Like, they're talking about, like, World War II, World War I, and most of the soldiers were men anyways. It's a good thought, but I don't think people care that much.
What's your name?
Erin.
Erin. Okay, Erin. What faculty are you in?
Science.
Science. Okay. What do you think about making the national anthem gender neutral?
It sounds like a great idea. I'm not from Canada, so I'm not even... very sure about what the anthem is, but gender neutral anything is great.
Awesome. So maybe from like an outsider's perspective, because you mentioned you're not from Canada, how do you think that would affect typical Canadian traditions?
I don't see why it should have any effect on it. I mean, I'm not sure exactly the like lyrics or anything of the anthem. So I don't know what implications changing it or what the plan changes are, but I don't see why it would have any negative effect.
My name's Christine, and that was this week's Hot Topic. Every Friday at noon, CITR reporters will be actively collecting statements on a controversial issue down at the sub's main level. So if you want to get your voice heard as a student, be sure to meet us there. Thanks for tuning in for this week's Hot Topic. Concerns are being
made. All right, that was Christine with Hot Topics. Next up is news correspondent Josh's piece on student concerns on the new UBC Mining Institute.
Concerns are being raised about a new UBC Mining Institute that is in its early stages.
UBC-SFU and École Polytechnique de Montréal were part of a coalition that was awarded a $25 million grant by the Canadian International Development Agency to open up the Canadian Institute for Extractive Industries and Development.
The Institute will also receive some $4 million in initial funding from strategic partners. The Institute's main function rests in helping developing nations make better use of their natural resources. It will act as a research and training center for technical knowledge while also focusing on policy and legislation related to resource extraction. The extractive industry of Asia, Africa, and Central America alone is worth about $1 trillion a year, a fact the Institute's press releases are quick to point out. However, the reputation of many international mining companies, including those based in Canada, is less than perfect. Colombia, Greece, and Nicaragua saw major protests against Canadian mining companies this year. The social and environmental impacts of mining are often very grim. The rising price of commodities means that the sector isn't going anywhere soon either. I talked to two UBC students who are part of a loosely knit group of individuals with questions about the Mining Institute and the way it'll be run.
Same here. My name is Simon Sheldon. I'm a third-year political science student, and I'm very concerned about some of the things my university is becoming associated with.
And how did you get involved?
I know Simon from being around on campus and going to some events that raise questions that are globally minded. And through that, Simon spoke to me about the Institute and asked me if I was interested in exploring some of our concerns. I know that personally I also have concerns about what this Institute could do on campus, but I also think that with some structural adjustments and as long as the goals that they claim to have are in fact what they try to do, I think that the Institute could potentially do some good.
So you're not really concerned with halting the industry, the Institute from happening as much as changing and making sure they're staying true to what they believe? Is that it?
I think that I know for myself that does hold true. However, the fact you stuttered over industry and institute is important to me. I want to make sure that this is an institute that is independent from industry, and it claims to have independence from industry. I also want it to, though it's being funded by the Canadian International Development Agency, also not be afraid to be aware of certain practices that are unethical that are held by Canada. And so I would like the Institute to be focused on Canadian legislation and ensuring that Canada has ethical practices both at home and abroad.
So, for you, Simon, what are your main concerns with this institute?
Well, there are many, and by no means is, you know, what I can just say here exhaustive, and there are many other concerns that students that I've spoke to have had. But mainly, they go around the issue of a conflict of interest, is I think what really the thread that ties many of the other issues together, in the sense that the Canadian government, you know, as many other governments do, has an explicit policy of promoting its corporate citizens and the interests of its investors overseas, as, you know, many governments do. And this institute is going to be funded by, as Emily was saying, the Canadian International Development Agency. So for those listeners who may not be aware, that's the branch of the Canadian government that deals with things like foreign aid and international development assistance and things of that nature, that this government body, which has supposedly its mandate of reducing poverty in developing countries, is funding this institute, which is going to be part of a larger foreign policy. And this larger foreign policy is those listeners who are following along to the things that have been going on at CETA or the Canadian International Development Agency know that international development policy in Canada has become increasingly tied to Canadian commercial interests and becoming about also benefiting Canadian corporate citizens. Now, this is not just my analysis. You know, this is not some left-wing critique. This is actually the discourse of the minister himself, or the former minister, Julian Fantino, who gave the grant to UBC, or gave this project to the coalition of UBC, SFU, and a school in Montreal. The important point that I want to make here is, and a point that's come up in discussion, in that many, you know, professors on campus are doing amazing work with grants from federal funding, and I don't want to discredit any of that and say that federal funding is bad. That's one thing. This is categorically different. This is the government saying that we have this institute that is part of our international development policy, which we have said before is for also, in addition to reducing poverty, also promoting our commercial interests. Which university wants to take this project on? That is a categorically different kind of funding. So I think it's very important to note that it is not, this institute was not UBC's idea, it was CETA and Ottawa's idea.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like this issue is relevant for UBC students? Is it something that they can get behind?
I think that it is absolutely key for UBC students. It is operating out of our own university, and my name is associated with this university. When I graduate, my degree will say, like, I have a degree in chemistry from the University of British Columbia. And we claim that we are protecting human rights from here. And I want to make sure that I believe that. And that when I graduate, I believe that the institute that I worked with, that I paid thousands of dollars to, that it is, in fact, a place that is ethically responsible. There have been moments where sometimes I feel like that's come into question for me, and I really feel like this institute could have the ability to have me have a lot of confidence in it. However, the way that it's currently set up, I am concerned that instead of it stopping the exploitation by Canadian mining companies, it might facilitate it. And that's something I'm quite concerned about. However, with small structural changes, so like really specific parts of this institute, I think that it might have the potential to be something that I could be proud of.
So what efforts are being taken by you guys to make sure that the institute is aligning itself properly with the university and with the responsible practices of the university?
First of all, I just want to echo Emily's point. I mean, I think that was on point, that this is something that as UBC students, our name and our educational privilege is going to be associated with now this institute, which is in turn part of a foreign policy, which is in turn part of a larger industry, which is very problematic. And although those problems aren't happening necessarily here on our campus, somewhere in the world, in Colombia, Guatemala, the Eastern Congo, they're having potentially very harmful effects on many vulnerable people. I'd also want to add, you know, one issue to this is an international institute, but the Canadian mining industry and the Canadian extractive industry also does not have a great reputation with Indigenous communities here in Canada. I mean, just look at the uprising around here with Idle No More and Bill C-45 and a lot of the environmental issues as well. So this is part of a much larger phenomenon that we're implicated in very different ways. But to answer a question, what are we doing? I think it's, first of all, educating ourselves. I mean, we can speak on specific examples of what it is about this institute that we have issues with. And through that education, thinking critically and then raising questions of the administration. We don't see necessarily that there is enough accountability in terms of this institute being held to those potentially redemptive principles which Emily talked about. And we think that students, therefore, have to hold their institutions accountable and ask very tough questions about, okay, this institute will work for mining, for development. Development for whom? In whose interests?
That was UBC students Emily Hopkins and Simon Child talking about the questions they have for the new UBC Mining Institute. Professor Benjamin Richardson is the director of UBC Law Faculty's Center for Law and the Environment. He was approached by the Institute for his input in its development. I spoke to him over the phone about what the Institute has the potential to accomplish.
I think what the Institute can do is help to nurture best practice standards. It can have an educative role. It can, through workshops, training, and education, sort of help build capacity. I mean, it alone, it doesn't have the capacity to dictate or regulate but it contributes in a measurable way, an important way, as we'll see, I think, over the next 5 years, mm-hmm. in helping to highlight the importance of sustainability.
Dr. Byron Klein is the acting director of the Canadian International Institute for Extractive Industries and Development. He is also the head of the Department of Mining Engineering here at UBC. I spoke to him at the Institute's new administrative space, located in a quiet part of campus. After our interview concluded, Klein talked about the possibility of having an open forum where students could voice their concerns and ask questions about the new Institute. He plans on having this forum before the end of the year. The Institute is currently in its internal development phase. Most of the offices are empty and the walls of the space are bare.
Why would UBC submit a proposal to CETA if there's already a mining school at UBC and the Norman B. Keble Institute for Mining Engineering, which has been committed to sustainable development and corporate social responsibility? Why would there be another institute?
Okay, so the institute actually falls, it's strongly linked to the Norman B. Keble Institute of Mining. The Norman B. Keble Institute of Mining is focused on undergraduate education and graduate student education and research. The institute is different from, it's not a department, it's not a university department. It's different because the intent of the institute is actually to work with national governments. So the client of the Keble Institute are the students, and the client of the Extractive Industries Institute are national governments in developing countries that have mineral, oil, and gas resource potential, but not necessarily a lot of experience in knowing what are the best practices in order so that those countries can benefit from those resources.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the strategic partners you're talking about. What is the vision for these partnerships? How they be working together? And to what end will they be working together?
Okay, so strategic partners, there's a whole spectrum of them. Lots of different types of organizations. As I said, other universities, sometimes NGOs, sometimes companies who have specialized services that might relate to environment or health that we want to engage, or in some cases it could also be mining companies who are working in a country who have knowledge of working in that country. So the way that we will engage them is, first of all, at the program development stage. I talked a little bit about this earlier, is when we're trying to understand what should the institute be doing, we really need to understand, well, what's already being done in a country. It might be that AusAid or CETA have already got some programs going on. We don't want to duplicate. We would rather coordinate and collaborate if that was the case. So we want to engage all of those strategic partners to help us better formulate what activities would be most effective, to set our priorities, and then once we've defined those activities, we will describe them in some type of a document, and that document will be reviewed for approval, suggesting that, okay, everything makes sense, falls within the mandate of the institute, go ahead. And then we will engage those strategic partners to actually help us deliver. For instance, if there's an expert in environmental sciences and health, and we want to improve the knowledge within a government about the environmental health implications of mining activities, we can engage that specialist. And they can come from a private sector company, from another university, or even from an NGO.
Can you talk about who these partners are? Like, other, like, kind of getting more specific apart from the types, like, I mean, there's a $4.3 billion in initial funding that was categorized under coming from strategic partners, mm-hmm. So where is that funding coming from?
Okay, so I'm not reluctant to talk about the partners. I'm very willing to, but mm-hmm. They agreed to support our proposal. They won't let us support. Right now, we aren't engaged with them, mm-hmm. and I think that, to be honest, I really want to get their permission to say, can we list you as a strategic partner? So I don't want to give specific names, but I can talk about, easily I can talk about the universities across Canada, the University of Toronto, McGill University, École Polytechnique, well, they're their coalition partner. York, it looks like University of Calgary will be a partner. So
NGOs?
Yeah, there are, but I want to ask their permission before I put their name out there.
What are the aspects of the Canadian mining industry, especially the companies working outside of Canada, like you talked about, need to improve? And what actions is the Institute taking to address those?
Well, the Institute doesn't work with industry. We are not, we don't deliver to industry, we deliver to national governments. Mm-hmm. And so, I guess that's the second part of your question. Quite often when an international mining company is working in a country, some of the issues that come up result from an inadequate knowledge within that country of how to manage resource development. In Canada, it's still evolving here. We don't necessarily do things as well as we should or could, and we're learning. And we're learning through a lot of mistakes. And in a similar way, mining companies working abroad are probably learning through those same types of mistakes. There's actually not a really big difference between the sensitivities of mining in Canada compared to anywhere else in the world. The issues are very similar. There isn't one specific issue. There's so many different countries that Canadian mining companies are working in, and the circumstances are different in every country. But because there isn't a lot of capacity in some of those countries, quite often the mining company has to play the role of both negotiating with the national government and informing the national government about what are the best practices.
But you won't be working with industry?
We're not working with industry, no. We're working with national governments. So we're an independent arm's length group that can inform those governments of best practices, and we aren't there to tell them what to do. We are there to say, okay, what are the best models for developing a resource economy? Is Chile a good model? What have they done over the last 25 years? And why are they the strongest economy in South America? Is Norway a good model for the way they've managed their oil and gas sector? But it really comes down to what are the local values and goals, because we can only provide them with the information. It's then up to them to take the ownership and do something with that information.
How will the Institute be held accountable, especially considering it was set up using federal funds? How will the governance of the Institute reflect the concerns of students and faculty in the school?
Okay. Well, also a great question. I think that we need to be judged on who we are, what we've done in the past, and what we will do in the future. We shouldn't be judged on speculation of what we might do, based on where the support came from. If the federal government wanted to continue development in the way that it has over the last years, they wouldn't have reached out to a university, which is a place where free thought and academic freedom are our values.
There's very little doubt that the Institute has the potential to bring positive change and development in resource-rich countries. To some extent, it's up to those at UBC to ensure that the Institute is not operating at the expense of communities and the environment, the developing world. However, it'll be a little while before we can be sure that the Institute's ethical convictions are as clean as its brand new walls.
Bill, thank you for being with us here.
Thanks, Josh, for that. We'd just like to take this opportunity to excuse our loving ourselves.
We're just having a great time hosting a show.
And we think we did a good show this week. So you're up next.
So to continue this amazing show, we have a report by Sarah. Sarah went to the 2013 Youth Forum. So the second annual 2013 Youth Forum opened last Saturday with great success. This year's forum focused on charting BC's economic future, exploring the social, environmental, and economic challenges of BC's economy. The event was hosted by the SFU Public Squares Community Summit in an effort to engage and connect with youth, our youth, with political makers, politicians, and
stakeholders, policymakers, not political makers. The forum began with UBC education lecturer Matt Harum, who challenged the youth to rethink economic growth and prosperity, insisting that a country's gross domestic product and better standard of living does not take into account people's personal satisfaction and happiness. The forum also included dialogue sessions with different policymakers, visionaries, entrepreneurs, media representatives, and other stakeholders. Finally, the forum also included a panel discussion with politicians. The 2013 Youth Forum will close today with a comedy night with CBC debaters Charlie Demers, Richard Side, and special guest Margot Kane as they unravel wealth creation, social equity, and environmental protection.
Nice. So we're going to be moving on to Morgan's segment. Morgan did a little segment about the welfare challenge. So here is her interview and her segment.
Bill, thank you for being with us here on News 101 today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we'd just like you to talk a little about what the welfare food challenge is. I'm aware that this is the second one that we've done, and I believe we did a little bit of coverage with you guys last year. Could you just explain to our listeners what the welfare food challenge is all about?
Certainly. Raise the Rates, an anti-poverty coalition in British Columbia, inviting people in BC to spend 1 week eating as if they were on welfare. We calculate that a single able-bodied person on welfare, after they paid for their rent, necessary expenditure like a cheap cell phone because they have to be looking for work, a tiny amount of money on keeping clean, about $10, and a few other things, that out of their total of $610, which is what they get in total, they would have left about $26 a week for food. So we're inviting people to spend 1 week eating only the food they can buy with $26 and not going to charity or food banks or any of those other things. Because, in a sense, the BC government assumes that $610 is enough. They don't build into the calculation that you can go and get some food from the back garden or go hunting or fishing or anything else. So for people to spend 1 week as if they were eating the diet of a single person on welfare, $26. And the week starts on World Food Day, which is October the 16th, and runs obviously for 1 week. So that's basically what it's about.
So can you tell us a little about the outcomes of last year's event?
Several years ago, one of the MLAs, members of the legislature, lived for a month on $610. And at the end of that month, he had lost 26 pounds in weight. And we pointed out to him that if he did this for 9 months, he would disappear. So we were working with ideas of what other ways can we raise public awareness around welfare and how inadequate it is. So last year, we issued the first of these challenges. We hoped it would be the last because the government would act, but unfortunately, welfare has not gone up, so we're doing it again. Last year, about 130, 140 people across the province did it. A few of them couldn't survive, and they stopped before the week was out, either because they were so hungry or they were just not functioning. I mean, I'll just give one example. One of the people doing this was a teacher, and she stopped a couple of days early because her concentration, her tolerance, were all not working. She wasn't functioning properly, and she was worried that she couldn't be a teacher because her temper was short, her concentration was limited. And this is one of the things that we know happens to people on welfare. They don't generally immediately die, although poverty is one of the biggest causes of premature death in the country. But they don't have enough food, they don't have enough nutrients to operate in a healthy, effective way. So here we have some of the most vulnerable and deprived people in the province who are then, it would seem, almost punished because sometimes they, you know, are short-tempered or the concentration isn't 100%, then that has consequences down the line. And we're basically, people cannot live on $610. There is no way, however you cut it, slice it or dice it, you can do it. I mean, one of the people who did it last year who actually did survive was a dietitian, and he says, like, I'm a trained chef, I'm a trained nutritionist, I'm a trained dietitian, and I can't do this. So it's not like if you're better educated, you could make your money last. You
right.
can't do it. And he said, well, he survived for a week. He was still there at the end of the week. But he could tell that he was suffering from a lack of certain nutrients. Again, his concentration, his temperament, his moods were all being affected by the inadequate diet. And again, One of the examples we're getting, like, we're speaking to people this year about doing it, and people are saying, well, I'd like to do it, but I have this dietary condition, which means I can't do it, or I have a major piece of work that I have to do that week, and I don't feel capable of doing it. But people on welfare don't have those choices. They may have dietary needs, and we know people on welfare who have dietary needs, but they don't have a choice. They can't go to the government and say, I need an extra $20 to look after my dietary needs. I need an extra $20 because I've got a job interview next week and I want to be 100% sharp and on the button. It has long-term consequences. We know this, that, I mean, for instance, the health costs to British Columbia alone of poverty, now this is wider than people on welfare, poverty is over $1 billion a year in extra costs to the public health of British Columbia, because people who are poor have higher rates of all sorts of diseases, of mental problems, and so on. And all these costs, you know, are paid by obviously the individuals, but also paid by society.
Right. And so, like, by raising welfare, it's more of a preventative approach.
I mean, there's a report from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives who estimated that the cost of poverty in British Columbia is somewhere between $8 and $9 billion a year. I mean, I've mentioned the health costs, but there's costs to the criminal justice system, the education system, and so on. And the cost of a comprehensive anti-poverty program, which would include child... We don't want people to be permanently ill. So people largely self-report. We will have a website which I'll give the
Okay, so along with our errors of talking and not turning off the microphone, we also seem to have an error with that file, so we are going to move on to another interview I did with Jessica Wang today about the U.S. government shutdown. So here is that. We'll try and make sure, I'll try and make sure I turn off the microphone this time. So this is the microphone being turned off. This is Jessica Wang from UBC's History Department to talk to us about the recent government shutdown in the U.S. Hello, Jessica.
Hello.
So, the first question I was going to ask is basically why this is happening, and if you could just explain it just for listeners to get a gist of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, basically what's happening is that the U.S. Congress, specifically the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republican Party, it's essentially holding budget negotiations hostage in an effort to try and defund or otherwise delay or impede implementation of the Affordable Care Act of 2010. So this is the health care reform bill in the United States that everyone has heard so much of about that passed in 2010, that was signed into law then, and which constitutes President Obama's signature legislative achievement. But ever since the signing of that bill into law, the Republicans have been trying to undermine health care reform in the United States. And so the current shutdown, what it follows is over 40 prior attempts in the Congress to try and either repeal the legislation or otherwise undermine it, and all of those attempts have failed. It also follows, of course, which this was in the news last year, a challenge to the law in the Supreme Court, and the bill largely survived that challenge through the Supreme Court's decision in 2012. So as I see it, at least, what we're watching here with the government shutdown is a kind of last-ditch effort to try and keep this legislation from going into full effect.
Well, what is their concern with Obamacare? What are they afraid of when it comes to this Obamacare?
Mm-hmm. I think the politics here are really quite complicated. You know, living in Canada, it just seems so bizarre, right? Why would anyone oppose universal health care? Why would anyone oppose extending health care to anyone or practically anyone and everyone?
you know, and why is it Americans are so willing to live with this kind of uncertainty in which so many people lack coverage, and in which even people who do have coverage often find that that coverage is inadequate? And why do people tolerate a system in which a major health crisis, you know, can throw a family into bankruptcy, for example, in addition to putting a family through all of the worries about just a person's survival?
Exactly. It seems ridiculous that this would even be a problem for them.
Yeah, it does seem ridiculous. And I confess, I too find it mystifying, even though I'm from the States originally. I think, you know, some of the opposition is ideological, and this goes back decades and decades to the early part of the 20th century. That, you know, for decades, there's been a discourse in the United States of condemning national health care as some kind of dangerously socialist activity, some kind
communist.
Of, yes, exactly. Some kind of something that's fundamentally un-American. So there's that ideological opposition. I think there are other factors as well, though. I think anti-communism by itself is a bit too simple. There are powerful lobbies at work. Historically, the American Medical Association was opposed to systems of universal health care, and it had considerable power as a lobby. In the 1990s, when the Clinton administration was trying to establish some kind of universal health care package, it also encountered opposition from the pharmaceutical, the insurance industry. So this kind of, this odd privatized system in which most Americans get their health care through employment, that system, which was largely, you know, established in the post-World War II period, you know, it's entrenched in certain ways and there are interests associated with it that also make health care reform difficult politically.
Exactly. It's not just a two-sided issue. I think there's so many different aspects of it that it
right.
can't just be we're getting health care or not, because so many people are attached to it and so many companies are making money off of privatized health care.
Exactly. I mean, the institutional apparatus, which is extremely unwieldy in the United States, nonetheless, it's been institutionalized and therefore has certain power and interest behind it. I think on top of that, there's also just the particular way, and again, this is part of American politics and its history, there's the particular way in which American conservatives have been able to capitalize upon that kind of innate American distrust of central governmental authority that's always kind of simmering beneath the surface of American politics. But that sort of baseline distrust, I think, has been exacerbated in the United States over the last 30 to 40 years through a complicated set of political circumstances that's produced an extreme polarization in American politics, and that's something we also see very much at work in the current impasse.
Yeah, but one of the things that's been pretty recent in the U.S. has been this, like, all of a sudden a movement, which was, I don't know if we could it started with the whole Occupy movement, but there's definitely been a movement in the United States for the first time in a while with young people sort of saying, this is not how we want to live, and, like, people who don't have money are just not living well in this country,
mm-hmm.
and people who do have taken everything. And so I was wondering if you think that this could lead to another mass sort of demonstration, kind of what we saw with Occupy Wall Street. Yesterday I saw a couple of articles that that were showing tweets
mm-hmm.
of certain people, and so many people were saying, we should fire Congress. This is their job, and they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think this could lead to another, like, huge demonstration, another Occupy sort of thing?
I mean, I guess we can wait and see. You know, and it would be very interesting if something like that emerged. At the same time, though, the other kind of mass movement that's at work here, and this is also why, you know, I mentioned the extreme polarization in American politics, is the kind of populism that the Tea Party movement represents. And to a certain extent, I think the wind has been taken out of the sails of both that movement and Occupy as mass movements. But one has to remember, you know, for everyone who is willing to kind of embrace a politics that responds to what it sees as, say, just an incredible maldistribution of wealth and the decreasing prospects that young Americans have. There's the other side of that movement that is suspicious of governmental power, that's suspicious of the kind of political change that it sees Washington, D.C. as representing. And so, you know, if there's a potential here for some kind of mass political movement, it can play both ways.
Okay.
I also think there are ways in which mass protest in America has sort of become so ritualized that it doesn't, you know, have much staying power anymore, in the sense that, you know, when you organize a major protest these days, there are a lot of rules you have to follow.
Yeah.
You get your parade permit or whatever and agree not to use certain streets and so forth. And, it, you know, there isn't much spontaneity in mass demonstrations.
Exactly, and I think that also takes away people's will to do it anymore.
I think that's right.
And also with, like, the whole platform changing to internet, it makes people a lot less likely to go out there and really fight for what it is, because with clicktivism, they're just clicking it and they're putting it as their status, or they're tweeting it, which in a sense can have power, but in a sense also makes them lose their power.
Exactly.
Because they're not going out there and doing it.
Exactly. It becomes a kind of passivity. And so what that means is, you know, Occupy was very easy to shut down. That yeah. Once the authorities decided that, say, health codes were in violation, yeah, you know, they sent the police in, and the movement dispersed.
Yeah, you mentioned this other side where there's people who are sort of the whole Occupy side, and then there's this other side that's suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who is categorized under that side? Is this a government side, or is this just a conservative population side?
Yeah, I mean, I think that suspicion of government power and of, you know, the so-called cry against so-called big government that we see in the United States, that's very common, it represents a particular branch of republicanism that's become very powerful in recent years. This particular form of conservatism that sees government as the source of problems rather than as a source of solutions.
Okay. Yeah, just to add to that, there's also right now, with happening with Edward Snowden, I think there's also a lot of, not distrust, but just questioning of the government and
mm-hmm.
if they're doing a good job, because all of a sudden people are looking at the U.S. as exactly what they never wanted. People are looking at the U.S. as kind of totalitarian in a way, because people look... that were just evidence of people who do stand out against government activities that they saw as wrong, and they said something about it, and then they get in trouble about it. So I think this whole issue with Obamacare is kind of can be coincided with that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it also speaks to the way in which there's certain kinds of political issues that, as polarized as the left and the right seem, they sort of, in a sense, come full circle and come together.
Yeah.
So that kind of
battling off.
Yeah, exactly. And so, this question of Edward Snowden and what that reveals about the NSA and mm-hmm. its capacity to do surveillance on American citizens, you know, that's an issue where I think, you know, the left and the right are both suspicious of governmental power. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in any functioning democracy, there needs to be that kind of suspicion and oversight, but there has to be a balance between that and also recognition of the functions that government serves, and the fact that we aren't just all atomized individuals, but we are a part of a common community, and that we require and need government,
exactly.
Even as we also have to have control and oversight over it.
Exactly. We need government, but we also need to be able to protest. What would this mean for Canada? Does it have any impacts in Canada, or is this going to be something that doesn't really cross the border?
Uh-huh. In terms of the kinds, the sort of politics that represent this?
Yeah, in terms of if their government has stopped right now,
right.
Is that going to impede any type of trade, is that going to stop something coming into Canada or Canada going into the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certain, it does create certain inconveniences. For example, if there are Canadians who need work visas or need any other kind of sort of visa-related work, you know, this is probably going to cause delays. Although I was reading that, for the moment,